Was there an Adam? Was there an Eve? Or did we evolve from what we conceived? Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.
We bit that apple and the garden was lost, and so we had to work to pay the cost. And so we went digging into the ground and started to burn many things we found.
Oh, yeah.
But don't you know we're gonna have a solar-topia.
That's the Divine Darwinian singing with the legendary Pete Seeger and David Burns, who wrote the words to that song, the solar Topia song, except for the word Solartopia, which I wrote. I'm Harvey Sluggo Wasserman, back with you another hour here at the Progressive Radio Network with the Solartopia Green Power and Wellness Show. We're going to talk about some nasty stuff today. First 40 minutes, we have two truly great guests, Barbara Arnwine. Barbara, you with us?
Yes. Hi there.
How you doing, Barbara? And Joel Siegel?
Yes. Hey, how are you doing there, Harvey?
All right. I am great here in the frozen Midwest in Columbus, Ohio, far from my usual perch in Los Angeles, but good to be here. And at 40 minutes after the hour, we're going to be joined by Lorna Salzman, talk about the longtime stalwart of Friends of the Earth, talk about nuclear power. But today we want to focus on some really nasty stuff, which is election theft and violence during elections. And we have seen, I have posted now a YouTube about this. It's available at my website, solartopia.org, about what has happened in Ohio on the signature gathering for a referendum to repeal a bailout of two nuclear plants. And it's something I have not seen before, and I know, Barbara, you talked about this at a recent conference about elections. So let me set the stage here. What has happened, and we have had a couple of shows about this on this show, the Green Power and Wellness Show, but it is about as serious as it gets, more serious in many ways than these impeachment hearings, which have been interesting and which, as far as I can see, aren't going to budge the other half, but we'll talk about that. But in Ohio, the legislature, which is completely corrupt and bought and gerrymandered, passed a what's called HB 6, House Bill 6, bailing out two nuclear plants on Lake Erie, which are about to blow up. These are two of the worst imaginable nuclear power plants you could ever think about. And the bailout's about $1 billion. And the public hates it. I mean, all the polls show that 60, 70, 80% of the people in Ohio do not want this bailout for these two nuclear plants. So when they passed it in the legislature, completely corrupt, a group arose to stop it, and they filed for a petition to put a referendum on the ballot in Ohio in the fall of 2020 to repeal this bailout, all perfectly legal. The attorney general has to approve these things, and he sat on them for 38 days. There's a 90-day window to get the signatures. And when they finally approved it, the nuclear industry ran a series of ads in the local media throughout the state. They're right out of Monty Python, blaming the Chinese government for wanting to take over our power grid if we repeal this bailout for these nuclear plants. I mean, I don't know what drug these guys are taking, but these ads just have to be seen to be believed. But then it got really, really, really ugly. The group sponsoring the referendum to repeal the bailout started hiring people to gather signatures. And when you do that, you have to register with the state to be a signature gatherer, including your phone number. And this is public record, and these people signature gatherers started getting threatening phone calls and bribery offers, $1,000 to not come to Ohio and gather signatures. And then when they went out in the field and started gathering signatures, there was violence. The pro-nuclear utility hired what they called blockers, basically Gestapo thugs, to terrorize and intimidate and threaten and in some cases actually do violence to people gathering signatures and people desiring to sign the petitions. This is new. This is not anything I've seen in American history. Now, I'm sure it's happened, but, you know, in modern times, we just haven't seen this. And and now we're headed towards an election in 2020, and Barbara Arnwine and Joel Siegel, starting with you, Barbara. And, Barbara, if you identify yourself, that would be great. Tell us how you want our listeners to know you and think of you. What do you think about the possibility that this kind of stuff can go on in 2020 and wind up with Donald Trump getting control of the White House?
Well, you know, people need to remember that this president has had no qualms about use of violence. But first of all, just a little bit about myself. I am Barbara Arnwine, the president and founder of the Transformative Justice Coalition. And I'm quite honored, Harvey, that you serve on my board, and I'm very honored that Joel is also on my board. And, you know, I really, you know, enjoy working with the two of you on so many, you know, great justice causes. And there's nothing more important than voting rights and nothing more important than climate change. And so all of these issues come together in protecting our, you know, our environment and fighting against polluting and toxic practices is right there at the top of the work that we have to do. People should know that, you know, for 26 years, I headed up the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights on the Law. I am still a president emeritus of the Lawyers Committee. And, you know, and enjoy, you know, the work that is done in fighting for racial justice. And that means voting rights is at the top of that spectrum. Voter suppression methods are often violent. Most people don't know because the stories got swept under the rug. But in November of 2018, because of the blue wave and everybody's focus on that, what was left out is all the violent challengers who showed up at different polling places in North Carolina in particular and in other states and attempted to scare black and brown voters from voting. So that kind of violence, also in Maryland, by the way, it happened at several precincts and some of the counties in Maryland where the challengers showed up and engaged in very violent, confrontations with people trying to vote. So in petition drives, one of the things that I don't think, Harvey, that most people realize is how critical ballot initiatives are, that, so much focus on the November 2018 elections was on the candidates that got elected, the amazingly powerful, wonderful congresspeople, people in state governments, people in local governments who were elected. But what people missed was that also there were 15 really amazingly progressive ballot initiatives that passed that affected voting rights, over 15. And there were several others that affected, you know, wages and other progressive, you know, decriminalization of marijuana, other progressive measures. And after the 2018 election, one of the big fights going on right now that most people aren't aware of is that a lot of these conservative states are pushing to end ballot initiatives or to make it extremely difficult for people to have ballot initiatives where we can demand, you know, a better, you know, climate policy, where we can demand, you know, nuclear plants not be built out or be decommissioned, whatever. They want to take away that power. And one thing that the Trump administration has ushered in is thuggery. Now, we saw some thuggery back in 2000 during the Bush versus Gore campaign, you know, after doing that whole fight about the vote and the problems with the vote in Florida. People probably forgotten that they bust in thugs to challenge people in the streets to you know, cause uproar. And indeed, that uproar was used to persuade people in power to reach out to Mr. Gore himself, to Al Gore, to tell him to stop, you know, all this challenging, to stop all this challenging the vote, to stop the fight, because you know, the potential for, you know, for civil severe civil disruption. These Thuglicans, as I call them, and that now, you know, are in power in North Carolina, in power in many other states, they are not adverse to using thuggery to basically try to block the democratic process. In fact, many people missed that a couple of months ago, the Thuglicans in Portland, Oregon, actually took over the state legislature for at least a day, where they tried to block the state legislature from operating and arrived there with guns and other things threatening the Democrats who were in office for, you know, having subpoenaed some of the Republicans to come back to vote and to force them to vote. So, you know, all of these incidents should have us worried. And thank you so much, Harvey, for, you know, focusing on this, because we're ignoring it to our detriment, that they are willing to use illegal, violent force to stay in power and to oppose a real democracy.
Well, Barbara Ironwine, have you written anything about this? Are there any articles that we are?
No, I should. You're making me realize I should. Because it's all tied together. You're making a, thank you so much.
Yeah, because our listeners need to be able to go look at something. I'm in the process of writing a piece. As I said, we took testimony from people in Ohio who were approached by these thugs on this petition drive. But an article by you, you know, somewhere online, that people could turn to would be a big plus. Siegel, please do, and of course let us know, and we'll send it around. And you know, this is a really critical thing. I had not known about the national push by the Republicans to get rid of the referendum. You know, the referendum came out of the pop.
Oh, it's everywhere. Florida, everywhere. They're trying to get rid of ballot initiatives or make it extremely difficult to be able to use them. It's really ugly.
Well,
big move.
What they did here in Ohio, you know, this came out of the populist and progressive era, at the turn of the 19th century, around 1900. The referendum was adopted, and the initiative referendum and recall were all adopted in many states, including Ohio. And in the beginning, all you had to do was submit petition and get on the ballot. Then in Ohio, they threw in this little thing that, well, now the attorney general, you have to go to the attorney general, and then he or she, I don't think we've ever had a female attorney general in Ohio, has to approve it, and they can take up to 20 days. So this year, of course, and since that was put in, the number of referenda has plummeted. And and this year, the people who wanted to repeal the nuclear bailout came to the Attorney General with a ballot initiative and 1,000 signatures. And the Attorney General sat there on the thing for 19 days. You know, he's required to respond in 20 days, so he waits 19 days and he turns them down. So then they came back with a redraft of the petition, and he waited another 19 days. And then he approved that one, but the window, the total window is 90 days. And so he ate up 38 of the 90 days.
Wow.
And now, so the people gathering the signatures for the referendum to overturn the bailout only had 52 days, and they fell short. So they sued. They went to court. They went to federal court and asked for the restoration of the 38 days that the Attorney General used up. And the federal judge said, well, this is a state issue, and he submitted to the state Supreme Court a series of questions to be answered about the situation. And, of course, the state Supreme Court, which is dominated by Republicans, is now doing exactly the same thing the Attorney General did, which is not respond.
Wow.
And so we've been waiting for weeks to hear from the state Supreme Court whether they believe, or, you know, they will rule that the 38 days that was eaten up by the Attorney General need to be restored. And in the brief that was filed, the group Ohioans Against Corporate Bailouts did cite the violence that was leveled at the signature gatherers as something that needed to be remedied. We had one instance where a so-called blocker was harassing a signature gatherer, and the signature gatherer took out his cell phone to take a picture of the blocker, and the blocker knocked the cell phone out of the guy's hands and stomped on it.
Wow.
But what the blocker didn't know was that they just happened to be in range of a security camera that was on a building. And so that went viral. And the blocker was actually charged with a misdemeanor. So, Joel Siegel, this all sounds and looks familiar to you. You are one of the great activists of our time, former assistant to Congressman John Conyers, and done a lot of work on election protection. Where does violence fit in now into to the Trump world here?
First of all, thank you for having me on your show. And it's nice when one of the greatest activists of our time gives me such a nice compliment. Your work on nuclear power and climate change and the environment is historical. And before I answer your question, I do want to say that Barbara Onwine is, in my opinion, the single most influential voter suppression activist. If you go to Congress with her, I don't care if it's Maxine Waters or Sheila Jackson Lee, they stop what they're doing when she, you know, enters the room, and they want to talk to her. She's been at this for decades. She is a legend. And she also hosts her own show called Igniting Change. So it's nice to hear, Barbara, you as a guest. You're a great host, but you're also a great guest.
Thank you, Joe. That's very kind.
I think what's happening, and I've spent most of my career in government, 13 years in Congress. But in 2004, I believe it was 2004, I worked with Jesse Jackson and Progressive Democrats of America because they called me up and said that there had been massive voter suppression in Ohio during the Kerry, campaign. And I couldn't believe what I was hearing, ballots being stuffed in garbage cans. And, so I talked to Mr. Conyers and I said, let's do hearings. Let's do some hearings. Let's do one hearing in the Judiciary Committee room with Jesse Jackson and the folks in Ohio, the, you know, anti-voter suppression activists. Then let's go to Ohio and let's go do the same thing there. And let's see if we can get C-SPAN coverage. And that is exactly, you know, what happened. Barbara, I can't remember if you were part of those hearings or not. But what I want to suggest is I think it's time for to do the same thing. I think
yes.
There needs to be congressional hearings led by the chair of the Judiciary Committee. I know, you know, Chairman Nadler, but there has to be a higher profile on voter suppression, whether it's in Alabama, whether it's in North Carolina, whether it's in Ohio, where they're still doing, thousands and thousands of voter purges. But I think the next step is there has to be a congressional priority as much as the impeachment inquiry into Donald Trump, because the violence that's being promulgated by Trump and by the, what do you call them, Barbara? The
Republicans.
What do you call them?
Republicans.
Yeah, it's, enough's enough. And it has to come to a point where there has to be hearings and there has to be witnesses that can really talk about the theft of our democracy, because we have moved and are moving so close to what you want to call it, crypto-fascism or fascism. I am concerned, yes. And I am worried. I'm glad you're doing this show, Harvey.
Well, it is the lifeblood of our democracy here. If people can't feel secure coming out to vote, we're in deep trouble. And I don't think anybody doubts that Donald Trump intends to do whatever it takes. I mean, Donald Trump is scared. If he loses the White House, he goes to the big house. So, no president really has, since Nixon, has ever looked at that kind of a progression here. Unless he can arrange a pardon from the incoming president, Donald Trump has got a lot to lose here. And clearly there's no ethical or moral constraints in his syllabus there. So, Barbara, how seriously do we need to take this, and what do we need to do?
Well, I think we certainly need to expose it more to make sure that it's, that people are able to collect these signatures. That in the future that people don't have to encounter this kind of thuggery when they're trying to exercise a democratic right that is afforded all our citizens. The problem with voter suppression is that by its nature, it is an attempt to cheat the system. Instead of competing in the realm of ideas for voters who support, different candidates on the basis of their positions, their platforms, you cheat. You steal votes. You block votes. You deny votes. You make it impossible for people to exercise their right to vote. And all of that is cheating at the very essence of it. And what I think, I know that Congresswoman Marsha Fudge, who is, heading up the special commission looking at voter suppression, did have a hearing in Ohio earlier this year. But it was a small, short hearing, and obviously some, effort to have a more substantial hearing there, or to have a more substantial meeting on this makes sense. I also want to say one thing that we've been doing at the Transformative Justice Coalition is that we've been traveling around the country, training voters. There's been a lot of demand for us to come to Ohio and do a program there. And I'm giving it, a lot of thought about how to make it happen. But, you know, but our role is to empower, you know, the voter. Our role is to empower activists who work with voters. Our role is to empower young people in particular. And the last thing I want to say is, and Joel has heard this from me, is that I have a special desire when it comes to clean energy, clean jobs, renewable energy. I have a special hope that we can build more of that industry in Alabama, especially for the people of Selma, the ninth poorest city in the United States, because of the fact that that city was responsible for getting the Voting Rights Act passed because of Bloody Sunday. So they've been punished by the Alabama state legislature ever since. And now it's an area of poverty and destitution. And what we should be thinking about is there a way to take the critical needs for clean energy to that area also? But I totally support everything you're doing, Harvey. The fight against these nuclear plants is critical. We should not be using nuclear energy. We're poisoning our environment. We're setting all of us at risk. I see that there's, all these efforts to build more nuclear plants around the world, where they're bribing and forcing African governments to take these nuclear plants or try to close loans on them and all these other kind of coercive measures that's being used to force the building of these plants when we should not be pursuing nuclear energy.
Absolutely. Very well stated. I want to point out also that we just had an incident yesterday. Medea Benjamin, one of our great activists, a co-founder of with Jody Evans of Code Pink, was at a demonstration about Venezuela and was holding a sign and was physically dragged out of the demonstration by Venezuelan fascists, and then was assaulted by police at her home, who charged her with disrupting the rally, which was utterly ridiculous. And, and this is Medea Benjamin, she's about barely 4 feet tall. And, she's a tiny woman. And to have her assaulted like that is right in Washington, D.C., by the way. And the D.C. police then came and charged her with disrupting the rally. I mean, this is really bad stuff. Joel, yes, you got thoughts on this, Joel Siegel?
Yeah, Medea has been left up, beat up, so many times, whether it was in the Middle East or here. We're very, very close, friends and colleagues, but at some point, there's going to have to be, this is one thing I learned from Barbara Armoire, is if you do not have punitive, whether you call it a sanction or a law that's passed with teeth behind it, i.e. if you rough someone up, you'll get fired from your job, i.e. if you rough someone up, you will be suspended, i.e. Until that happens, I don't think that there will be much change, because right now I feel like, at least the whether it's the D.C. police or, police in general, they're not even given a slap on the wrist. I mean, she's about, 5'2", maybe 90 pounds, and she's exercising her constitutional right and her duty, to strengthen democracy and do the right thing. She believes in nonviolence. She's fantastic in terms of her effectiveness as a social justice advocate. But I just think there has to be some penalties for roughing up people exercising the First Amendment. That's what I think.
Yeah, I mean, it's really, really dangerous. And I'm not sure what we can do as a nonviolent movement. I've asked, if we get back where we're able to start gathering signatures in Ohio, then we are going to make sure that everybody has cameras, everybody has their cell phones ready to shoot, and that, you know, we video this wherever we possibly can. The one woman who did knock away the cell phone was charged, but, you know, it's only because we had video of it, which was accidental. So at this point in time, you know, it's a reality we have to face. I also want to mention, of course, we're almost going to be soon joined by Lorna, switch a bit to nuclear issues. I want to talk about the impeachment. I watched much of yesterday's hearing, and in a sane world, I mean, that would have been the end of Donald Trump. But, you know, we're seeing no or very little movement among his supporters. Certainly not a single congressman or senator, congressperson or senator. Are there any Republican women in the Congress? I think there must be. But, you know, nothing is going to shake these people. You know, Donald Trump famously said that he could shoot somebody on Fifth Avenue and nothing would happen to him. And I think the Republicans are proving this right. I mean, clearly he broke the law and did what the Democrats say he's going to do. I actually met Adam Schiff. I begged him to take up money laundering. And he said they might. You know, Trump made his fortune after he lost everything his daddy gave him. He remade his fortune by laundering money from the Russians. That's why he's owned by Putin. And I begged Adam Schiff to take it up, and he said he might, actually. So let's see if that happens. I also, by the way, I asked him to start referring to Trump as Fredo. for those of you who've seen The Godfather. And he pretended, Adam Schiff pretended to not know what I was saying. You know, he got this really weird look. What are you talking about? But I know that Adam Schiff knows who Fredo was. The person who really needs to start calling him Fredo is Robert De Niro. So hopefully we can get to him. But very quickly, Barbara Arnwine, your thoughts on this impeachment and what's going on here?
Well, you know, obviously, you know, my organization, of course, is a 501c3. So I'm not speaking for my organization when I talk about impeachment. I'm just talking as Barbara Arnwine, the citizen. And Barbara Arnwine, the citizen, wants to observe that these impeachment hearings are critical, that this president is operating with impunity. He is, you know, making he has violated the emoluments clause by trying to make himself even richer off the presidency. We still have no justice for the murder of Jamal Khashoggi. We still are dealing with, you know, his, you know, just, you know, all of his bribing trying to use military aid to bribe a country to investigate for political purposes his, quote, rival son. I mean, there's just all of these violations, obstruction of justice, all the things that he's done. He clearly needs to be impeached on those bases. I also think that, you know, back for a minute, back to this issue of the intimidation, everybody should know that there's an actual law that's being proposed that that is the Anti-Deceptive Practices and Anti-Intimidation Law. And, you know, and once again, you know, it's in the McConnell graveyard. Because people have been trying to move it through the Senate and through, you know, the House. It's so important that people understand that that law will help in some of what we've been talking about protecting the petitioners, holding people accountable for trying to use violence, to deter, you know, people from exercising their vote, all of that. is important. So I just wanted to get that into the mix. And let's mention that while we're talking about the Thuglicans, the Georgia Thuglicans, which are some of the ugliest ones in the country, they in the Wisconsin are always in competition. But the Georgia Thuglicans, as you know, Harvey, they're trying to investigate activists who are trying to hold the and make sure the machines in Georgia are, you know, proper machinery and that they're not hackable and that people are being transparent about the, you know, about the machines that are being used in Georgia and how bad they are and the need to bring in a new system that's not worse, but that is better than what used to be there. And they're actually investigating these activists, trying to accuse them of being in areas that they should not be in so they can prosecute them. I mean, this is terrible. And I think it's just more of the thuggery that we're seeing out there threatening our democracy.
Absolutely. Joel?
I agree with Barbara. I know I like the analogy of Fredo. I also think that, you know, great. The Godfather. If people are seeing the Godfather, you know, in action. And I just had lunch with my nephew. It was his 34th birthday. And I asked him and his girlfriend, what did you think about the impeachment proceedings? And he had watched them on CNN. And he basically just said, you know, this is a disgrace. You know,
yes.
President Trump has committed impeachable offenses. You know, there seemed to be a quid pro quo. But I think what's going to happen is the seed of doubt about this man and you know, his criminality and his immoral and unethical actions. There are millions and millions of people who may have been on the fence about Mr. Trump. I think after these proceedings are over, they're going to say, you know what, this guy should not be in the Oval Office.
Right.
But I do find it unbelievably frightening that the President of the United States was, you know, about to get away with a high crime and misdemeanor. And people were like, well, you know, that's the new normal. And I am proud of Representative Schiff for I thought he did a pretty good job. People are often very critical of Nancy Pelosi. I'm proud of her, but I think that at the end of all this, I think that the country will be better off, and I think democracy will be strengthened. But you know, it's just the beginning. But I feel better today than I did, you know, before yesterday.
Well, they did a very good job. I thought Schiff did a very good job, and of course, the two testifiers were extremely effective, and I think the Republicans looked like fools. But you know, in my world, to me, I think the reason—and correct me if I'm wrong—one of the reasons that Trump's support is so solid is because there's such a dislike, especially among working people, of the corporate Democrats. I mean, you had a candidate in 2016 who referred to half the country as deplorables. So, you know, if on the one hand, Trump is despicable, and I think, by the way, in the long term, the biggest losers from Donald Trump are the evangelicals. I mean, I used to take evangelicals, you know, I think it's they are what they are, but I used to say, okay, well, you can believe in what you believe in. But for the evangelical movement to support such a worthless piece of garbage like Donald Trump, who operates in contradiction to all their so-called morals, is beyond me. But I think that the problem with the unshakability, at least so far, of Donald Trump's support is that the corporate Democrats are so deeply disliked. And, you know, and many millions of Trump supporters love Bernie, you know, and they seem to like Elizabeth Warren. But when you get into the thick of the corporate Democrats, there's no there for for working people in this country. Barbara, what do you think about that?
Well, I think that actually, you know, I feel a little bit different. I think that the Trump's base is very limited. You know, let's be very clear. It's not a huge, pervasive base. He's not 40% of the population. He's not of the voting population. He's not at there. I mean, he's got severe disapproval rates, and they only get worse. They're not getting better for him. And his base is going to be the base. I mean, we know, you know, those of us who do this racial justice work, know that a good 20% of all Americans are easily led into a fascistic mode. Racist mode. It's just easy. It's easy for anybody to play on those tendencies. And 20% of the population will go along with that. But that means 80% isn't. And that we just have to, you know, we got to stick in here, be very clear that most people are saying that they're tired of Trump already, that they want him to go. He's lost ground with women where he, you know, did very well in 2016. He's lost ground with independents severely who are just like, he's got to go. And that to me is one of the most encouraging signs, given the huge percentage of the electorate that is independent. But the Republicans are staying in there with him, especially, you know, the hardest core ones, but they're not dominant. They don't control the electorate. They're not enough by themselves to win the next election. So people need to, you know, look at it. I mean, this is ours to win. When I say ours to win, meaning those who believe in justice, those who are opposed to this kind of, you know, neo-fascism that Trump is putting forth. And I think, Harvey, you know, the reason why people like Bernie, who also like Trump, is that they want somebody to be mad for them. You know, people are upset that this world has left them behind. Economically, do you look at how rare you ever hear anybody ever talk anymore on the floor of Congress or anywhere else about the American dream? Because we have made it acceptable to believe that people, 140 million Americans, should be economically insecure in this country, that we don't know what to do if we miss one paycheck. I mean, that is wrong. And when they hear Bernie saying that, they relate. And when they hear Trump saying it, they relate too. The problem is that not enough people are saying it. This should be being said by every single politician, and not said, but worked on. Because and Congress could do more to help the American people.
I agree with you 100%. Warner Salzman, are you with us? Can you hear me?
I'm here. I hope it's going to be a little louder.
Can you hear me? Yes, I can hear you. You're fine. Can you hear me?
You're faint. I can hear you, but it's faint.
All right. Well, listen, as long as you can hear me, it's fine. Warner Salzman, is
that the loudest you can speak?
Yes, it is.
All right. I'll put this very close to my ear.
That's good. Okay, so Warner Salzman, we went through this before. When a third person is on the phone, it's sometimes difficult to hear, but if you can hear me, that's good enough at this point.
Just make sure you speak slowly and clearly.
Okay. So, Lorna Salzman, you're on with the great Barbara Arnwine and the great Joel Siegel, and we've been talking about the rise of violence at the polls and a threat that it poses to the 2020 election. And I wanted to, you are a long-standing activist with Friends of the Earth, and I have great expertise in the nuclear power issue. And I wanted to bring you on in part because of the referendum that we're trying to finally get on the ballot here in Ohio about the two nuclear plants. And I wanted you to talk to us in general about nuclear power. one of the things that one of the reasons for this at this point in time is that we never had much to have put our trust in with the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, but Donald Trump's people have gutted it even more. I mean, we have three of the five commissioners who are running the Atomic Energy Commission, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, are Trump people. And they have basically done away with inspection and any kind of oversight. So, Lorna Salzman, can you give us an expert's eye view of where we stand right now with the nuclear power industry in the age of Trump?
Well, okay, I'm not with Friends of the Earth anymore. That organization was basically destroyed by the managerial elite, and it's a long history. And I guess Sluggo and I are probably a kind of handful of the institutional memory of the anti-nuclear movement. And it was an amazing movement. It was a grassroots movement without any sort of hierarchy, elitism. It was quite amazing, and someone really should relive it. I mean, there are books, and Anna Georgi's book wrote about it. But it was quite an amazing, democratic, open, grassroots movement, and actually tremendously successful, and I'm very proud to have been, a small part of it. Now, as far as what we have now, and Trump, and all the things you've just mentioned, I'm really wondering whether, in fact, what we have now is, in some ways, better for the activists than what we had before. Because what we had before, in the 70s, when we were fighting nuclear power, was that we had the trappings of citizen participation and democracy and regulation and so forth and so on. And we don't have them now. What we had then was very subtle, internal, private, secret manipulations of the democratic process, studies that were commissioned and by the government to cover ups so everything was sort of under wraps, and so it was much harder to uncover the double dealing and what was actually going on. So now what we have is much more overt and much more challenging, but there is a difference, and this is a very important difference, that because of what happened in that era, it was incumbent on the anti-nuclear movement to essentially create its own media. Not only its own media, it created its own campaigns, movements, protests, articles, and so forth and so on. So we had to really do our homework, and we did, and it was a tremendous fight. What we have now is much harder because we do not have people, for whatever reason, that's a whole other radio program there, for whatever reason we have a public that is distracted by whole bunches of other side issues. And they may be more important to those particular people, but to environmental activists like myself, they are less important. I don't want to tell people what they should do politically. That's their decision about what they want to work on. I respect their decision. But just the simple fact is that environmentally, and particularly with regard to science, we have regressed to the pre-Earth Day date, to the situation, like Earth Day 1970, which was kind of the opening, the explosion of it. And we had a tremendous decade following that of legislation and all kinds of, not only just education, but the institutionalization of environmentalism through legislation, through the establishment of agencies and departments at the state level, at the local level. So it was a tremendously creative decade, which ended with Reagan around 1980, and then all the major environmental groups sort of went off in their own direction, raising money and becoming cozy with corporations and so forth. That's another separate program. I've written a lot about this, but what we have today, all right, so fast forward to today, what we have is a citizenry that is very agitated, very alarmed, very, very, very concerned, sort of nonstop worrying and fear about what's happening with Trump, with the right wing, with racism, with Putin, with all this kind of stuff. But he's not as concerned with what's happening to the planet. I'm not saying, actually there are many groups, these are the youth groups that we are now seeing, who are concerned. But the general public, and I mean the informed public, the more liberal public, so I mean the right-wing climate deniers or anything like that, is generally not as informed on these environmental issues as they used to be, and they don't seem to care as much. And this is very disturbing to many of us. Now, there is a lot. I'm not going to deny that people are getting alarmed, but how many people are actually reading the reports that are coming out, the declarations by the scientists saying where we are in terms of climate change, the loss of biodiversity? How many people are actually reading that stuff and taking it to heart? Let me give you an example. It's very disturbing. I read a lot of blogs from right to left, center, the whole. I read them all. The new blog called Heated, H-E-A-T-E-D, Heated, having to do with it. And the woman who runs it's named Emily Atkins, and the first thing I read of hers was a couple weeks ago about how she's really, really fearful and concerned about climate. And she writes in a very colloquial style. It's informal. It's refreshing. It's fresh. It's new. It's personal. It's good. She seems to get to read a lot. She seems to get around. Goes to things in Washington.
Lorna seems to be
on top of things. Lorna. So today I open her blog, and I read down that she's having a conversation with another woman. And then in one paragraph towards the end, Emily, the one who runs the blog, says something about overpopulation. That what? Don't be ridiculous. We don't have to worry about that.
Okay, so
Lorna,
I'm
serious.
Lorna, I know you're having a hard time.
You can read it yourself.
Lorna!
So I'm reading this. And here's this woman who's concerned. Sets up a blog specifically to deal with climate change. And then makes this incredible statement about we don't have to worry about overpopulation. Maybe in this country we don't have to worry about it. We have to worry about overconsumption. But we should have to worry about overpopulation in other parts of the world, in Africa and the Middle East
Lorna,
and so forth.
Lorna,
so that's just one example. And I don't think it's unusual. I don't think it's exceptional. I think we're dealing with a generation of people that for whom the environmental issues, whether it was energy or biodiversity or wilderness or the oceans or so forth, it wasn't on their radar. And the only reason that they accepted it because it came from fairly reliable and not right-wing sources. So therefore, they're right. We probably do have environmental problems.
So now we're looking at
nuclear power, okay, which was a tremendous opportunity, and a lot of people educated themselves and taught other people about it.
Okay.
And then it sort of died down because we haven't had a new reactor licensed in this country since around 1978, although there are obviously in other countries in Europe, there's quite a few of them. So what we have now is everything kind of quiet on the nuclear front, which is not good because then they can sneak things in. And of course, what you're talking about now, this Ohio referendum, is just one of the little sneaky things that are coming in. And of course, the public that is now how many years older, 40 years older than they were in the 1970s when we were fighting nukes, they never heard of it. They didn't know anything about nuclear power. They haven't got a clue. And as far as they're concerned, the election and Trump and who knows what else and social justice warriors and all that's what concerns them.
Okay,
so there's not going to be any attention to it. And what are we going to do? Do we have to revive the entire anti-nuclear movement to push this whole issue onto the? How are we going to do it? Who is going to help us? Not only there's no one to help us, but it took us a long time to even get the media interested in the 1970s to take it seriously. But we're talking now of that the only voices that are being heard on nuclear power are these unbelievable jerky scientists who are talking about the fourth generation of nukes and all these, and we're going to have all these little nuclear power plants scattered all over, and they're going to heat our houses and run our cars, and there's no waste problem and no terrorist problem. So these guys are promoting essentially, I don't know, their own jobs, maybe. We don't know. And so that's all that you're going to read. And even someone so incredibly informed and respected as Jim Hansen on the climate issue, he gets up there and starts talking, and no one asks him to. I mean, let him talk about climate, that's fine, but he always seems to have to want to push in there that nuclear power is going to save us. And then you have people like the psychologist Steven Pinker in Enlightenment Now, and then you have the Breakthrough Institute, the Schellenberger and Nordhaus. So all the voices you have now are promoting this, you know, some fourth generation nukes, which there's no money for, which the investors aren't going to invest in, which would have to be completely subsidized by the government. Wall Street's probably not even interested, but these guys are still pushing it. And then you have little sneaky things about the referendum. I'm not up to snuff on the details of this referendum, so I'm not able to really to talk about it, and I don't know the politics behind it, the people that are involved, and what and how it's playing out. So I'm not exactly the right person to comment on that specifically. But I just wanted to give this overview of where we are on the environment and.
Lorna. Hello.
So, any more questions?
All right, thank you, Lorna. That was a very good summary. We appreciate it. We're almost out of time.
You have to, for one few seconds, I heard you very clearly, and then you faded.
Okay, thank you. Well, thank you for that summary, Lorna. It was much appreciated. We're almost out of time. Barbara Arnwine, thank you so much for being on with us.
Thank you for having me.
No, I'm sorry. Say that again.
And Joel Siegel, thank you for being on with us. Thank you so much.
It's an honor. It's an honor, man. A pleasure.
And Lorna, thank you for your summary. We appreciate it. Nuclear power is really a problem with us today, and it's more terrifying than ever because we absolutely have no, as Lorna has pointed out, we have the anti-nuclear movement is different. We have a situation in California. We can't even get the so-called liberal governor of California to inspect the Diablo Canyon nuclear plants. And thank you so much, crew in New York. We will see you next week. Barbara, Joel, and Lorna, thank you so much. See you next week in Thortopia.
We conceived. Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down.